and thanks to the organizers for putting on a great workshop. This is joint work with Sergey Bravi and Ramiz Mavassa at IBM, and we have a paper on the archive. So the first few slides you may have seen me talk about before, but hopefully this will get you back into the zone of thinking about constant depth circuits. So circuit depth is the number of time steps in a quantum circuit allowing for parallel gates. So we're going to consider circuits composed of gates that have, like, you know, act on one or two qubits. And gates can be applied in parallel when they act on disjoint sets of qubits. So this is a circuit with three such time steps. And so we'd call that a depth three circuit.
David, sorry,
yes.
Can you speak a little louder?
Yes. Is this, I think it's on. Maybe it's, it is on. But, maybe I'll just move this up. Is that better? Okay. All right, so circuit depth. So we're going to be interested in constant depth circuits. So if you think of the number of qubits as being like the height, the circuit depth as being some kind of width of this picture, constant depth means that this dimension is not growing with n. And why should you study these shallow quantum circuits? Well, when, you know, these small quantum computers that are being built, they don't have error correction. And so, you know, there's a sort of strict limit on the circuit size that you can implement with a given error rate. So, you know, that sort of causes us to look at either circuits with small qubits, which is less interesting because it's classically simulable, or small circuit depth. Obviously, these shallow circuits are more simple than the family of polynomial-sized quantum circuits. And that structure has been and can be exploited for various purposes. And finally, shallow quantum circuits have a surprising computational power that I'll talk about on the next slide. OK, so what are they good for? So we've known since around 2002 from this pioneering work of Terhal and DiVincenzo that if you take take a bunch of qubits, initialize in all zeros, apply even a depth three quantum circuit, and then measure all the qubits in the computational basis, this allows you to sample from a probability distribution that cannot be sampled classically unless the polynomial hierarchy collapses. And recent works have attempted to make this statement robust to noise. So even if the classical simulator is only asked to sample from a distribution that's close to the output distribution of the circuit, it is still believed that that is not possible in polynomial time. Okay. We also know that there are certain linear algebra problems. So these now are problems that can be solved in polynomial time on a classical computer because they're linear algebra problems. But we know that they can be solved faster on a quantum computer in the sense that a constant depth quantum circuit can solve these problems, but they cannot be solved by any constant depth classical circuit. So these are some things that constant depth quantum circuits are good for. But is there anything else? And if you sort of look at what's being done in industry, it's not this stuff, really. I mean, OK, the quantum supremacy, I guess, has its origins in the Terhal DiVincenzo work. So it could be viewed as an outgrowth of that. But a lot of work has really focused on these variational quantum algorithms, which Peter spoke about yesterday. So these are sort of near-term algorithms, such as the variational quantum eigensolver. And although these have been proposed and implemented in many cases, I would say that there's still work to be done to understand what they can do in principle or in theory. So let me just describe at some very high level what these variational quantum algorithms do. So the goal is to minimize the energy of a Hamiltonian. Let's assume the Hamiltonian acts on qubits, and it's a sum of Pauli terms. So let's suppose that each term here is an n-qubit Pauli operator. And our goal is to compute the minimum energy of this Hamiltonian, ground energy. Okay, so this variational quantum algorithm that Peter spoke about and that we saw in one of the previous slides, it sort of has a couple of assumptions. So the first assumption is that your quantum device, whatever it is, can prepare a subset of n qubit states. So this is a very mild assumption. We have some ancillas prepared in the zero state. We have some knob settings, like in your lab. And you tune the knob settings, and then you get some state psi. And maybe ranging over all of these knob settings, you can explore a set of states that I'll call S. Okay. We're going to be interested in the case where S consists of states that can be prepared by constant depth quantum circuits. Okay. And the second assumption is that the device can also be used to measure the energy of any of these states that it can prepare. Okay. And that's usually achieved by computing the mean values of each of these n qubit Paulis individually and then summing. Okay. So this is sort of, again, a very mild assumption. So you can think of now the way the quantum device is being used here is you have some knob settings, and they just you run it through the quantum device, and it gives you an estimate of the energy. Okay, and this involves some averaging, and we talked about the overhead of that averaging yesterday. But for the purpose of this talk, you just think of the quantum device as something that measures energy for you for some subset of states S. Okay, so a variational quantum algorithm, the aim then is to compute the minimum energy of a state that your quantum device can prepare. So it's going to minimize the energy over the states in S. So what does the algorithm do? Well, you start with some knob setting that prepares a state psi 1. You measure the energy of psi 1. Then you use a classical computer to choose the next knob setting. So you get some psi 2. You measure the energy of psi 2. Use the classical computer again to choose the next knob settings. And your goal there is just to, you know, this classical computer, what is it trying to do? It's trying to go downhill in energy. Okay, so maybe there's some gradient descent algorithm or some other heuristic. But that's sort of the main idea. And you can see from this why it's so appealing to experimentalists, because we've made very few assumptions about the quantum device. And you could imagine this as sort of a meta algorithm which runs on almost anything that you could build. OK. So what are these algorithms good for? Well, there's a lot of papers about them. And many things have been proposed. So I think Peter's talk focused on the chemistry simulations, which I think is viewed as one of the most promising applications of these algorithms. But there have also been some more speculative things, such as this variational quantum factoring paper, and some suggestions to use these algorithms for machine learning and so on. So unfortunately, like, we don't have performance guarantees for these algorithms for a couple of reasons. One is that, well, we're only exploring some subset of states S. And so we don't really know if the actual minimum over that subset of states of the energy is close to the true ground energy. So we don't know, even if you could optimize over the state S that you're, you know, let's say we're talking about constant depth circuits, we don't know how well this approximates that. The second challenge is we actually don't know how well you can minimize even over a given set of states S. Like, even if it's depth one circuits, that minimization can be NP hard, for example. So these are sort of two challenges, and kind of, you know, you might throw up your hands and say, well, I just don't know how to simulate these things. Or I don't know how to analyze this algorithm, so let's just try it out on a whole lot of in a whole lot of experimental settings, which is a reasonable thing to do. But we could also ask a more basic question, like, you know, can they in principle have any algorithmic speed up over classical computers? And one way to address that question is through the following question. So we observe that the quantum computer in these algorithms is only used to compute mean values of observables at the output of a quantum computation. We have some observable O, maybe it's an n qubit Pauli. We have a circuit U that the quantum computer implements, and we're using the quantum computer to estimate energies like this. So then you can just ask, how hard is this problem? And in particular, is it classically simulable? Or when is it classically simulable? And when, conversely, could we have a hope of getting a quantum speed up? So let me just say that at this point, like, our results are kind of going to bifurcate from things that are really practical. And we're just going to make a bunch of statements about this problem in settings that are related to the setting that I've motivated here, but maybe don't, you know, we don't really make contact, I would say, with the most, maybe the most pressing questions about these algorithms. Okay, so this is our motivation. And, you know, I'll state our results, but I should mention that we're not, you know, disproving, like, the utility of these algorithms, for example. Okay. Are there questions about the setup? All right. So we're going to define this mean value problem. So we're going to have a depth d quantum circuit, and we're going to think of d being a constant. We're going to take our observable to be a tensor product of single qubit Hermitian operators, O1, tensor O2, tensor On. So maybe this is an n qubit Pauli. And we're interested in estimating the mean value mu at the output of this quantum circuit. We're going to assume, for technical reasons, that the norms of all of these single qubit observables are less than or equal to 1. Okay, so let me just also note that there's an interesting special case where we take this observable to just project onto some computational basis state x1, x2 up to xn. And then, of course, this mean value is just an output probability of the quantum circuit. Okay. Okay. So let's just there's sort of different variants you can define of this problem depending on what quality of approximation you ask for. So a natural version to consider is this, what I'll call the additive error mean value problem. So here's the problem where we ask only for an approximation mu tilde that differs from this mean value by an inverse polynomial, at most an inverse polynomial amount, an additive error. And this additive error mean value problem for shallow or even polynomial sized circuits can, of course, be efficiently solved on a quantum computer by just running the quantum circuit, measuring the observable, and then repeating. We could also consider a different variant of this problem that I'll call the relative error mean value problem. So here again, we're given an inverse polynomial error, but now we're asked to have, you know, this mu tilde has to be within like, it's upper bounded by mu times 1 plus epsilon and lower bounded by mu times 1 minus epsilon. And so like when mu is small, this is a much more stringent notion of approximation. And this problem is known to be Sharpe hard. And you can see that even just in the special case that I talked about earlier, where you're asked to approximate an output probability to a given relative error. This is a very hard problem. Not even a quantum computer can solve this problem. OK, so we have two versions of this mean value problem. OK, so now I want to talk about like our results and how they fit into the context of what was previously known. So this is kind of what I just wrote on the previous slide. So we have a, if we have a polynomial size quantum circuit, so now we're on this line, it's not constant depth. This line is just for comparison. The polynomial size quantum circuit, let's say we take the observables to be positive semi-definite. So for example, this includes the case of approximating an out probability. Then the relative error task is Sharpe hard, and the additive error task is, in fact, BQP complete. OK, so what about constant depth circuits? So now I'm going to fill in a table. So our first result pertains to the case where all of the single qubit observables are close to the identity. Now this might seem like very strange, and maybe maybe it is very strange, but in any case, what I want to point out here is that even if all the observables are close to the identity, their tensor product may not be. Okay, and that's kind of going to be the case where we're interested in. And I'll talk more about what this means as we go on. But there is this case where all the single qubit observables are close to the identity. And we can show that even the relative error version of this problem, this very stringent notion of approximation, turns out to be in P. So it can be, we can approximate these mean values in polynomial time on a classical computer. And of course, that implies that the additive error version is also in P. OK. So this is a more general question of when we have a constant depth circuit and now positive semi-definite observables. So this now includes the case of approximating output probabilities. But now we're going to ask, OK, so again, if you ask for relative error, even the constant depth version is, again, Sharpe hard. You know, the reduction between these two is basically just the Terhal-DiVincenzo result that I mentioned earlier. But the additive error case, so we know again that it's in BQP because you can approximate mean values to additive error on a quantum computer. But we give a sub-exponential classical algorithm for additive error approximations of this type. So that's our second result. And then our third result pertains to the case of two-dimensional constant depth circuits. And maybe this is the closest to sort of what is maybe experimentally relevant. So if your circuit is constant depth and every gate is nearest neighbor on a 2D grid, and let's say the observables are just general Hermitian observables, well, again, the relative error problem is very hard. It turns out there's a sub-exponential classical algorithm based on the fact that, based on tensor network contraction. But we show that the additive error version of this problem, so if you want to, for example, compute the expected value of, like, a Pauli operator at the output of a 2D constant depth circuit, you can do that in randomized, in bounded error probabilistic polynomial time. OK. So, yes?
So, is Sharpe hard and sub exponential compatible?
Well, so the reduction, you know, like sub exponential in terms of n, the number of qubits, but there's it's still like exponential in root n. So,
yeah. So, exponential in
square root of n.
Okay. Yeah.
It's basically because on a 2D grid, you know, there are these algorithms based on tensor network contraction, and that they depend on the tree width of the graph, and the tree width of a 2D grid is square root the number of vertices. Okay. Anyways, in the rest of the talk, I was going to describe these classical simulation algorithms, these three, which are our new results. Yes?
Relative error and additive error, those are equivalent to strong simulation and weak simulation?
Sometimes it's called strong simulation and weak simulation, although actually strong simulation is often not even relative error. So I didn't use those words because they're a little bit they mean different things. Like weak simulation can mean actually sampling, which is actually a stronger task than additive error. And then strong simulation can mean zero error. So I didn't use those words for that reason. Yeah. Okay.
Excuse me. So does this result depend on epsilon?
So these, I mean, I'm quoting runtimes for inverse polynomial epsilon.
So the exponent of the n long line.
You'll see. You'll see the exponents. Yeah. Okay. So so most of the talk, I'm actually going to speak about this case where we have a constant depth circuit and the observables are close to the identity. And the reason for that is somehow this is the most technically interesting case. Although, you know, if you're motivated by contact with experiments, maybe you think this is the most interesting. And anyways, for whatever reason, aesthetically, this is maybe the most technically interesting, so I'm going to talk about that for the majority of the talk. So what is the actual restriction? So we have a n qubit observable, it's a tensor product, and every single qubit factor in the tensor product has to be close to the identity in a way that's like inverse exponential in the depth. But notice that it only depends on the depth and not on the number of qubits. Okay, so this operator is not close to the identity in general. Right, so that's what I just said. Now, if you actually do care about 2D circuits, and then in fact this can be replaced by a slightly milder function of depth. Okay, so there's some function of depth here that, in fact, depends on the light cone structure of the circuit, and for 2D circuits, it's a little bit milder than inverse exponential in D. And I want to emphasize again that in this part of the talk, we're interested in this very highly demanding relative error approximation. So there's sort of, Okay, so this is the setup. Here's mu. Let me give you an example of how this might arise. So if you have a quantum circuit and ignore this epsilon for a minute, imagine it wasn't there, then this would be the output probability of measuring all zeros at the output of this quantum circuit u, okay? Now, what is this epsilon? This epsilon is like for every qubit, we're just gonna, before we measure, we're just going to flip each bit with probability p. So this is like an independent noise on every qubit. Okay. So now, if we consider the noisy version of this mean value, then you can easily show that it's proportional to an ideal mean value, where the single qubit observables are now shifted towards the identity. Okay. So like if p is close to for example, if p is 1/2, this observable is the identity. Okay? So in other words, the case of, like, a special case of this problem is the case where you want to estimate an output probability, but you have noise before the measurements, and the noise is close to, you know, the noise is pretty bad. Like, it's close to as bad as it could be, but only in a way that depends on the depth. Okay, so that's one motivating thing for why you might care about this variant of the problem. Okay, so what's our theorem? So I said we're going to get a relative error estimate of the mean value, and I'm hoping that you can parse this. So what we've done here is we've rephrased that as an additive error estimate of the log, okay? And that's going to be convenient for you'll see when I describe the technique. So this I've taken logs here, so a relative error estimate of mu becomes an additive error estimate of log mu. Okay? And that's what this is saying. And here now we get the statement of the runtime for this algorithm, which has an exponent that depends on 2 to the d. Okay? So I don't know if this answers your question, Benny, about the dependence on delta and the depth. So delta here is epsilon from before, basically. And this is the d is the circuit depth. Okay? You can see that the dependence on the depth is quite poor. But if the depth is constant, it's polynomial time. Okay. So how does this algorithm work? I emphasize that this solves this relative error mean value problem and that the runtime can be improved. So not only, I mentioned before that this condition can be improved for 2D circuits, but it's also true that the runtime can be improved for 2D geometrically local circuits. Okay. So the algorithm, the reason why I think it's kind of interesting is because it's based on this polynomial interpolation method due to Barvanok, which has recently also been used by some other authors in other settings in quantum computing. Actually, we had a very nice talk at the Quantum Innovators Conference last month by Saeed Mehrabian, who is currently at Caltech. And he's done some work in this area. And his talk was entirely about sort of how we can use this Barvanok method in different quantum settings. And sort of, you know, he has this sort of like vision of maybe that it might be useful in various settings in quantum computing. So this maybe fits into that narrative. Okay. So so I said polynomial, so what's the polynomial? Well, we're gonna just modify this single qubit observable that we start with, and we're gonna define OJ of epsilon for every J, which just interpolates between the identity and the observable. This should be OJ. So now when we construct this tensor product of those OJs, we get a degree n polynomial f of epsilon, okay, which is the expected value of this O of epsilon. All right? This is a degree n polynomial. When epsilon is zero, then only this identity term fires, and this whole thing is just one. When epsilon is 1, this identity term disappears, and we get the thing that we want, which is mu, the mean value. Okay, so epsilon is 0, we know the value of this polynomial, and epsilon is 1, that's the value that we want to compute. Another thing to observe is that if you have some low-order derivatives of f, if u is a constant depth circuit, you can efficiently compute those low-order derivatives. Okay, so one way to see that, like, for example, let's take the kth derivative where k is 1, okay, the first derivative. So then, using this, I guess it's the product rule or chain rule, whatever that rule is for
product.
Okay. Yeah. So then we just pull out one factor of O. You know, we get a sum of n terms, one for each of the terms in the product, and so each term involves the expected value of just one of these single qubit observables, and we're conjugating by a constant depth circuit. When you conjugate a single qubit observable by a depth d circuit, you get an observable supported on 2 to the d qubits, which is still constant. Okay, so this operator acts non-trivially on just 2 to the d qubits. So to compute an expected value, we have to do a computation with just a constant number of qubits. So that can be done in a constant amount of time for each term, and then we have an overhead of n. So the point is that low-order derivatives can be computed efficiently. And we know the value at 0, so it's natural to try to use some kind of Taylor series expansion to evaluate the polynomial's value at 1, which is what we want to compute. But this actually is not quite the right thing to do in this setting. What Barvanok says, and maybe, so Barvanok's strategy is to instead use the Taylor series for the log of the function. And the reason for that is because you want additive error in the log, because that will translate into relative error in the function value itself, right? If you just expanded the function value, you get additive error in the function value, which is really not nearly as good as additive error in the log. Okay, so this is kind of one of the key points of Barvanok's method. So we're going to look at the log of this polynomial. Okay, so here's the log of the polynomial, we'll call it g. We want to compute its value at 1. So we're going to consider the truncated Taylor series, truncated at the pth order of the log. Okay? This is the Taylor series about 0, truncated at the pth order. And what Barvanok's theorem says is that as long as you have a zero-free disk for the polynomial itself around 0, then you can basically interpolate within that disk. So for example, if you have a disk of radius 2, all that matters is that this 2 is bigger than this 1. you know, if it gets very close to the 1, then you have to be careful. So I just stated it for 2 and 1, okay? So if the polynomial is zero free on this disk of radius 2, then the sense in which, or the error in this approximation of the log by its truncated Taylor series actually decreases exponentially with p, okay? So this is a very good, like then you only have to take an order here, p being like log n, to get inverse polynomial error in the approximation of the log, okay? So you only need to consider a logarithmic number of derivatives of g, okay? And that's helpful. So you need a zero-free region, you need to be able to compute the derivatives. That's kind of key here, okay? Right, so this is what I just said. P just needs to be logarithmic and n in the error. Okay, so to use this, we need two ingredients. One is that we need the derivatives of the log. There's one important step here, which is that the derivatives of the log are related to the derivatives of the function. So if you have the first, sorry, this should, one derivatives 1 to p are actually related to derivatives of the function from 1 to p by a right, by the chain rule. Yes. Thank you. Yeah, good. David's on top of things. OK, so the point is that there's a linear system that, in fact, the chain rule gives you a linear, you know, a set of linear equations that relate these derivatives to these derivatives. So as long as you can you know, all we need to do is to compute the first logarithmically many derivatives of the function. And I kind of showed you how we do that on the previous slide, although that's, I'm not going to go into detail about this, but it's basically what I said on the previous slide. OK, so we know how to compute the derivatives. That's good. But we also need to show that this function is zero-free on a disk, let's say, of radius 2. And this is in the complex plane, right? So we have to consider this function for complex values of epsilon and show it's zero-free. And that's kind of maybe one of the main technical contributions of our work.
What about the accuracy of the derivatives?
Accuracy of the derivatives. Well,
get them exactly, I guess.
Yeah, we get them exactly. Right. Exactly up to, let's say, up to exponential error. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Are there questions about this? Good. Okay, so now I have to show you how we prove a zero-free region. So here's our polynomial. What's our theorem? Our theorem says that if each of these single qubit observables minus the identity is at most gamma, so this gamma is supposed to be small, right? Ultimately, we're going to take this gamma to be small. But what it says is that this polynomial f has no zeros in a disk, which is like constant over gamma times this exponential factor of d. So remember that d is the depth of the unitary. So if you choose gamma to be, you know, inverse exponential in d, which is what I said we were going to do, then we can make this disk radius equal to 2, and then we can just straightforwardly use the theorem statement that I mentioned on the previous slide. OK.
David,
yeah.
Is this tight?
Yeah, I'll comment on that. But up to this 5, it's tight. Yeah, up to a constant factor in the exponential. OK. So let me give you the sketch of the proof for this zero-free region. So here's our polynomial. OK, so the first thing is that this O, these OJ of epsilon, even if so O is only required to be Hermitian. But what we want is we want these O of epsilons to be unitary. It's just going to make the proof simpler. So what we're going to do is we're going to embed these operators as the upper left block of a 4x4 unitary. Okay, their norms are less than 1. So let's fix epsilon. Then we're going to embed this OJ of epsilon as the upper left block of a unitary B. Okay, and so now we replace n qubits with 2n qubits because we need an extra qubit for each O to do this embedding. So now we have a similar polynomial. It's just that now these B's are unitary. Okay, so this is a straightforward trick. Then now that because these B's are unitary, we can define a set of gates, which are just like U dagger BJ U. And so now this is just we can express this polynomial as the amplitude of getting zeros at the output of a circuit composed of these gates. Vj of epsilon. And each of these gates, again, because this Bj acts on only 2 qubits, when you conjugate by a constant depth circuit, you know, these Vj's also act on only a constant number of qubits. Okay? Moreover, because the Oj's were assumed to be close to the identity, the BJs are close to the identity, and the VJs are close to the identity. So here we have a constant depth circuit where every gate is close to the identity. In fact, these gates also commute one another. Okay. So we've just recast the problem in this way. But now we want to show that this F doesn't become zero. So what we're going to do is we're going to consider a probability distribution, which is like you apply the circuit V of epsilon, and then you measure in the computational basis. And we want to show that the probability of getting all zeros is positive, that it's not zero. Okay. Does anyone know a way for showing that a probability distribution? Does anyone have a guess how to do this? We recast it as a problem about probability distributions. Okay, well, I'll tell you. So what we're going to do is we're going to consider a set of events, EJ, which EJ is the event that the jth bit is 1. So these are like bad events. And we're going to show that each of these EJs occurs with a small probability that depends only on the depth, the upper bound on the distance to the identity, and this epsilon. So each of these events occur, these are bad events. We want to show that the probability that none of the bad events occur is positive. So we're going to show that the probability that each of them occurs individually is very small. And we're going to show that they're, each one is independent of a large number of, almost all of the others. Okay. So if you've seen this before, this is, okay, so this, maybe I won't get into the details of how we show this, but this follows from the sort of constant depth of the circuit. But the reason for showing these two things is that the Lovage local lemma is a combinatorial result, which tells you that if you have a probability space, and you have a bunch of bad events, and each of them has a low probability individually of occurring, and they're sort of mostly independent of one another, then you can show that under some constraint on how independent they are and how small these probabilities are, as long as this condition holds, you can show that the probability of none of the bad events occurring is positive. Okay, and that's what we do here. So, if you just plug in this bound on the individual probabilities and this bound on the dependencies into this equation, which is the condition of the Lovage local lemma, you will get the theorem statement about the zero free radius that I mentioned earlier. Okay. Okay. So now that's kind of the proof sketch, and now I want to address Debbie's question. So, can you improve this bound on the zero free radius? Well, in the worst case, the answer is no, because you can consider a circuit that prepares a cat state on 2 to the d qubits, which now this circuit is going to be depth d. And then if you just take a set of observables like this, and you construct this polynomial, then it turns out to be this function of epsilon and d. And then you can show that it has a root, which is roughly 1 over 2 to the d. Okay, so in the worst case, the zero-free radius must decrease exponentially with d. Okay, that's what this is showing. But an interesting fact is that although this is true in the worst case, it's not true for generic random circuits. So if you have a random circuit, the zero-free radius is much larger. So let's, again, restrict our attention to observables diagonal on the z basis, like this. Then we show that as long as your circuit is drawn from a 2 design, so it doesn't need to be fully Haar random, then the zero free radius actually goes to 1. It approaches 1 as n becomes large. So this is a stark difference between the case of random circuits and worst case. Okay, I'll skip this. Okay, so that's the first part of the talk, and I think I have 5 minutes for the rest. So it's good that I removed almost all the slides in this section. So this is the statement about positive semi-definite observables. So I want to just, I will go over this because I think this is interesting. So we have, here we have a tensor product of observables O1 tensor On. The norms, let's say, are 1. This algorithm has sub-exponential time. The scaling with depth is very poor, but it has sub-exponential time that scales only with root n in the exponential, and it will estimate for you the absolute value of the mean. Okay, So if these observables are all positive semi-definite, then this absolute value will be equal to the mean value, and so this will estimate the thing that you want. It's kind of frustrating that we cannot remove this absolute value here. Somehow this algorithm does not let you compute the sign, which is very strange and is one of the open questions that we leave. Can you get a sub-exponential algorithm for estimating the mean value, including the sign? We don't know. So I did not include the details of this classical algorithm, but you can ask me about it afterwards. It's based on based on polynomial approximations. This square root n comes from a Chebyshev polynomial, if you like. OK, and then the last case, which I will go through very quickly, pertains to 2D shallow circuits. So remember, the result here is that if you have a constant depth two-dimensional circuit and you care about estimating the mean value up to a given additive error, we can do this in BPP. So how does that work? And I should mention, this improves upon the previous thing, remember, is sub-exponential time. And so even if we're talking just about positive semi-definite observables, this BPP is much better than sub-exponential sub-exponential time. OK. So the setting here is that the qubits are located at the vertices of a 2D grid. U is a depth D quantum circuit. Each gate acts between nearest neighbors. So for example, you might have a circuit that prepares a graph state. Okay, so then we would take one layer of Hadamards. We would cover all the edges of the grid with controlled Zs. We need four layers. And that, that's just an example of a circuit on a 2D grid. So what's our theorem? Our theorem says that you can additively approximate the mean value. And the runtime of the algorithm, now Benny, I want to point out here for your benefit that there is also a dependence on D in this algorithm, which again is very poor. It's 2 to the order D squared. So this overhead, this is a constant for a fixed D, but this is a very bad constant. And I'll mention where that comes from. But if you were willing to ignore that, it's linear time. So I don't know. Okay. So the algorithm is based on matrix product states and a Monte Carlo method. And I'll just go over it briefly. So the first thing that we do is we express this mean value, again, as the amplitude of a constant depth circuit with commuting gates. The way we do that is, again, we just write these qn, these gates, as u dagger oju, and then write this as a product. In this case, when you conjugate a single qubit observable by this 2D constant depth circuit, every layer can expand the support of the operator by a distance of 1. So when you conjugate by this u dagger of depth d on a 2D grid, you get an operator that's supported on a 2D by 2D square region that's centered at qubit j. Okay, so this is the support. This should be qj. This is the support of q sub j. Okay? So we have these gates, and they sort of act on these square regions of size 2D by 2D. By the way, the 2 to the order d squared that we saw in the runtime, it comes from the fact that this is d squared qubits. Okay? So then we're going to coarse grain. So we're going to group the qubits into supersites of this 2D by 2D size. And then if you do that, then each of these gates acts only on one plaquette consisting of 4 of these supersites. So now we have a circuit which is just, we have these supersites. Their local dimension is like d squared, 2 to the d squared. But each of these gates only acts on one plaquette. And they commute. So then what we do is we consider the plaque, the gates which act on this column, and then the gates which act on this column. And notice that we've removed the gates that act in between here. And if we only consider the part of the circuit that consists of these gates, then what we get is a tensor product of matrix product states. Okay, each of these columns, the state prepared by these gates in this column form a matrix product state with qdits of dimension 2 to the d squared, and likewise over here. So we get a tensor product, call that phi odd, because these are like the odd columns. And then we could do the same thing for the middle column, and we would get this phi even. So what we're trying to do here is compute the inner product between two states, which individually are tensor products of matrix product states. And then, okay, so this is a bit trite, but what we're going to do then is use the fact that it's known how to compute inner products between matrix product states, even with different orderings of the qubits. Okay, so this is a, remember, we're only asking for an additive error approximation here. And so for that additive error estimation of this inner product, there's an algorithm due to Van den Nest from 2009, which is basically a sort of straightforward Monte Carlo method. And that's all I'll say about that. OK, so this is the little summary, which you've seen before. So maybe I'll finish with just the open problem. So the maybe the biggest question is, what is the complexity of this additive error mean value problem for constant depth circuits? So we have a sub-exponential algorithm when the operators are positive semi-definite. So like, can that be generalized to the case where they're not positive semi-definite? Can the sub-exponential scaling be improved to polynomial? Those are two big questions. Can this 2D algorithm be generalized to higher dimensional lattices? We talk about three dimensions, but we don't really have a good algorithm in that case. It becomes, again, sub-exponential and probably could be improved. And then finally, are there other applications for this zero-free region? Or, you know, along the lines of Saeed's suggestion, can we find other uses of this Barvanach method in quantum computing? OK, so I'll end there. Thanks.
So we have a little time for questions.
You already commented on the thickness of your analysis for this zero-free region.
Yeah.
But what about the interpolation method itself? Mm-hmm. Because like your function is very special. It's analytical. It's polynomial, in fact. Mm-hmm. So do you think you can improve that value?
Well, that method is really only for polynomials. I would say that probably we're not the right people to improve that bound. Maybe that's the answer. So I guess the answer is I don't know how to improve it, but because it is, we are kind of using it in the way it's meant to be used. So if it could be improved in that setting, I would have hoped that it would have already been done. But yeah. Yes.
May I see the right of the example?
Sorry. Go back to the slide about the zero-free region?
Yeah.
For random circuits, this
yeah.
one? Yeah.
But Barvanach method require epsilon to be greater than 1, then does it mean this theorem, and in this case, cannot be applied in our case?
Sorry?
So Barvanach method require
yes.
epsilon to be greater than 1, right?
Well, no. So Barvanach's method, you can always rescale things. So what it says is that you can interpolate almost up to the zero free radius. When you get right at the zero free radius, things kind of break. But if you want to interpolate like almost up to this radius, then you can do that using Barvanach's method. So I stated it for, you know, taking the radius to be 2 and then the region where you're interpolating to be 1. But as long as those two things are separated by, say, a constant or some small function of n, then you're in good shape. Yeah.
Hi. So in the last part of your, you know, the algorithm, you mentioned that the overlap of the two NPS can be computed by Monte Carlo
mm-hmm.
method.
Yeah.
Why is this sign-free problem?
Why is this?
Sign-free
problem. Oh, it's not a quantum Monte Carlo method.
Oh.
It's like a much more straightforward Monte Carlo method. So both of those states are what Van den Nest called CT states. What he means by that is that you can both efficiently compute their amplitudes to a very high precision, and you can efficiently sample from the output distributions. And when you have those two things for any pair of states, then you can use this method of Van den Nest to compute an additive error approximation. And it's really a fairly straightforward method once you have those two things. Yes?
Do you think this last method can be applied to efficiently sample the syndrome of the surface code with
non-Pauli noise? So I guess I haven't thought about that. But yeah, I don't know off the top of my head. But maybe we could talk about that later.
much.
And let's thank you again.